present the News Quiz with your host, Sandy Toksvig.
The News Quiz. We start with a cutting from Hampshire Health Watch magazine, read by Neil Sleet.
New poll reveals surveys are a waste of time.
And our thanks to Kath Gillett for sending that in. Now let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Rebecca Front and Jeremy Hardy. And opposite them on my left, Hugo Rifkin and Justin Morehouse. Rebecca, who this week, as a mark of respect, did not strike?
Big Ben.
Yes, 2 points. Next question. Yeah.
Baroness Thatcher, I should just reiterate, died last week.
I know
you covered it, but I'm shocked by the fact that the media have been very quiet
about
it.
I know.
Very, very understated it's all been. So, obviously, yes, the funeral this week. And the important thing to remember is it wasn't a state funeral. It wasn't,
right,
Sandy, a state funeral.
Okay.
It was an intimate funeral.
Yes.
Just family, friends, St. Paul's Cathedral, men with braid and the Queen. So very, very much like your average sort of funeral. Anyway, it was all very grand and full of pomp, very expensive. I've no idea how expensive, but when you see the Chancellor of the Exchequer in tears, you know... I think it is all right in this age of austerity, because fortunately a lot of people just a few days before had given up their benefits, so I think it's all fine and we can probably afford it. But by and large, it all went off quite smoothly. There were protests, as everybody knew there would be. Lots of people turned their backs. I actually genuinely got slightly confused because I switched on some time into it and thought, oh, there seems to be a mass police protest because all the police are standing with their backs. A, that they had to stand with their backs to it so they could watch the crowd, and B, that I'm very, very stupid. And the press were terribly happy because it turns out she's got very photogenic grandchildren.
Yes.
So there was the Pippa effect. Mm. It was
she's
all
like,
fine.
She's 19, isn't she?
She's 19.
19 years old. One of the youngest people present, I presumably because organisers had warned that the ceremony wouldn't be suitable for minors.
I didn't enjoy the funeral, because I don't really enjoy funerals, but I was disappointed that they cancelled Homes Under the Hammer. BBC One, which is, if you're not aware, is a programme about people who get their houses repossessed and then they're sold at auction to spiff landlords. It's kind of apt that it should have been on, really. They should have held it back and showed that. And you mentioned George Osborne crying. I read the thing in the paper today which made me stop and think about the world in which we live in. This was an actual quote from Tony Blair's former spin doctor, Lance Prince, who said, "The footage of George Osborne crying won't do his image any harm." What a twisted world we've ended up in.
Even on the day Cameron was interviewed, he said, well, today's a day for setting aside politics and really to remember to vote Conservative at the next general election. And it did make that funeral reminded you what horrible friends she had. I was thinking, blimey, she didn't half know some horrible people, didn't she? I mean, there's Netanyahu, Tony Blair, Henry Kissinger. I mean, I'd be lucky to get half a dozen, but at least they won't be mass murderers and Andrew Lloyd Webber. It's just so... Because, oh, look, there's F.W. de Klerk. There's Jeffrey Archer. Oh, there's Kelvin McKenzie. I haven't seen so many scary white men in one place since I was at Wimbledon dog track.
It was terrifying because you hadn't seen a lot of those people for a very long time. It was like somebody had left the heating on in the studio where they recorded Spitting Image. Times said that the women were dressed soberly and respectfully. What did they think they were going to come in day glow onesies? And I love this. The Queen came dressed as herself.
Wouldn't it be brilliant if she comes dressed as Pudsey?
Yeah. Mr. Blobby.
It was extraordinary, the emphasis on the fashion. It was like it was a kind of monochrome ascot.
Normally, all the funerals I go to, it's like the funeral, and then you go back to a pub with a flat roof. You know, they're really poor estate. you know you're working class when the wake is in a pub with a flat roof, and it's basically, you know, it's boiled egg sandwiches, and that pie, that pork pie with an egg in the middle. How long are those eggs, by the way? do the chickens look like that way, those eggs?
Hugo, were you surprised that there was less protest?
No, because, I mean, everyone expected there to be lots of protest in the same way there's been loads and loads of coverage. But, I mean, like, I'm 36. When I think of kind of Grand Zero Britain, it's Thatcher's Britain. I don't remember what Britain was like before Thatcher. And there's an awful lot of people who are younger than me who are just not really that sure why she would be important to anyone or what they'd protest about or why they'd bother lining the streets. She's just an old lady to them. And so I think it's kind of... I mean, there's no joke at the end of this, but...
But it says something about how bleak the news has been this week, that one of the lighter stories is the funeral of this old woman.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. My dad, who knew her well, made a speech in the Commons when they had the debate after she died, and he said that it was often said that she had no wit and that she wasn't a consensus politician, but he wants her to say that she did believe in consensus because there should be consensus behind her convictions. And he said he thought that was wit at the time, but as the years went by, he became less sure.
The funeral for Baroness Thatcher was held on Wednesday and saw Big Ben silenced as a mark of respect for the first time since Sir Winston Churchill was laid to rest in 1965. The silencing of Big Ben was a fine tribute which moved many to tears and left even more people unsure about whether the lunchtime news had started. The Times described the funeral as fitting and moving. The Guardian said it was truly dignified, while Variety said it was Meryl Streep's greatest performance to date. 2 points to Rebecca. Jeremy, who met with Blair to clear the air?
Ed Miliband, because Blair is being like the sort of spectre at the feast. He's being a nightmare, Blair. And Ed Miliband should go and say, look, can you shut up? There's a reason why you're not Prime Minister anymore. It's because you're a warmongering weirdo and everyone hates you. Can you just bog off? Just go and just enjoy your wealth and ponce about pretending you're bringing peace to the Middle East and giving your speaking tours for the rest of your life until your face falls off. Just go away.
I have to say, I think Tony Blair's criticism has been a sort of mixed blessing for Ed Miliband, because on the one hand, it has reduced his party's confidence in him as a leader, but on the other, it has reminded everyone who he is. So... That's quite a good thing. We've kind of forgotten about it.
The criticism was that Labour shouldn't just be a party of opposition. Mm. And I thought, well, it would be a start, though, wouldn't it?
Well, Blair said he could find no evidence that the Labour Party was making substantial leaps forward. And I thought, that's the first time I've ever seen him concerned about finding evidence.
The thing I love about Ed Miliband is the way he seems to basically make policy and create positions on the basis of film titles. Because first he had The New Generation, which was like a Star Trek film, if you remember that. It was all going to be Ed Miliband's New Generation. Then he had that great Predators versus Producers, which was like a sci-fi, because the producers hold onto your face and lay an egg in your brain. Okay. And his most recent one was that he's worried about a lost decade, which sounds a bit like The Hangover. You know, it's sort of last era. It's sort of economic turmoil forever and ever, but you're really, really hoping that eventually a rich Chinese guy jumps out of the boot.
One Nation sounds bad. One Nation sounds like some people who come seventh on X Factor, doesn't it?
They're keen on a slogan, though, all politicians now, aren't they? Because Lord Prescott tried to come to Miliband's aid, and his slogan was, "Let's stop complaining and get campaigning," which is better than his earlier effort, which was, "Leave him, Tony, it's not worth it."
Prescott was doing this thing. You always know a political party's in trouble when they start calling for unity. And Prescott was doing this thing where he was saying, yeah, we need to all be together, we need to unite. The people we need to watch out are the ones who are trying to split the party, the bastards. Let's turn on them and have unity.
The papers I read were saying that Miliband was turning on the Blairites. And you think, these people are Blairites, and we had the Thatcherites we're remembered of, and we have the Brownites. The problem is Miliband's people haven't got a name. Because it couldn't really be called the Milibanites, because that sounds like something you have wrong with you downstairs, isn't it?
I think Milibandite sounds like some people that Moses smote.
What are Miliband supporters called, though? What are they, the Miliband band? Milibanders?
You don't need a name for them, because there aren't any.
Ed Miliband has met with Tony Blair in a bid to clear the air after the ex-Prime Minister issued a public warning that the party was drifting too far to the left. In a piece for last week's New Statesman, Blair said the Labour Party is back as the party opposing Tory cuts, which immediately prompted Ed Miliband to add opposing Tory cuts to his to-do list. Tony Blair was elected head of the Labour Party in 1994 following the death of John Smith, while Ed Miliband became leader in 2010 after collecting 30 tokens from packets of Cocoa Pops. 2 points to Jeremy. Hugo, listen to this. Home, home.
sweet, sweet home. There's no place like home. There's no place like home.
Hugo, who said, "Not in my backyard," to the government?
Rebels.
Yes.
Rebels said this. The government has this policy spearheaded by Eric Pickles, I think. They want to allow people to build extensions on the back of their houses of up to 8 metres without planning permission. Now, there's a big rebellion because some other Conservatives have realised this might mean people will put big things on the back of their houses. So there's this big uproar. The rebellion's being led by Zach Goldsmith, who doesn't understand why people want to put extensions on their houses, because he thinks if you want a bigger house, just move to one. What's the problem? Or just go to one of your bigger ones. What's really interesting about this is it shows the schism between two completely different types of Tories. Because on the one hand, you've got your Eric Pickles kind of pull yourselves up by your bootstraps. You need to have a big extension on the back of your house that's bigger than your neighbour's extension to make up for the size of your penis sort of thing. And on the other hand, you've got your traditional kind of NIMBY Tories, not in my backyard, who think, well, I'm already completely happy with the size of my extension and my penis. And I don't want anyone having an extension or penis extension that's going to threaten that.
Old penis, new penis kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, you've got half the Tories saying no to bigger penises.
Do you know, honestly, I'm never going to be able to look at another conservatory. It's just... I'm excited about the whole thing, about extending. I live on a boat on the Thames, and my new conservatory is going to be built on the terrace of the House of Commons. I think it's absolutely fantastic.
In London, forgive me if I'm wrong, I keep mentioning it like I've never been before, but I'm in London.
There's something very sweet and wide-eyed. Have you bought an A to Z and have been wandering around with your mouth open?
The point is, in London, I believe that it's difficult for a lot of people to extend because you're already cramped and you're already on top of each other and, you know, you live your lives and never smile. And... a lot of people are going underground, aren't they? They're building dungeons.
Yes, bunkers.
Now, I don't know if anybody's read 50 Shades of Grey, but he has a dungeon just for the sex. It's amazing. And I thought, you know what, if I had a dungeon, it wouldn't just be for sex, it'd be for a couple of lawnmowers as well. Her mum's table that we only ever use at Christmas would be in there as well, alongside me gallows or whatever I'd have in there. I've not thought about it, I'll be honest with you.
Dozens of government MPs staged a backbench rebellion about Eric Pickles' proposals for planning regulation laws to be relaxed. The new plans would allow homeowners to extend up to 8 metres without planning permission, which is great news if you live in a block of flats. Pickles has promised to bring forward a compromise when the bill is introduced in the House of Lords. I say introduced, the bill will actually be extended from the Commons 20 feet into the House. 2 points to Hugo. Justin, why has a row about a school trip gone nuclear?
All right, this is the story of the Panorama programme, which was filmed in North Korea, jumping on the back of a school trip. They have a similar programme in North Korea, it's called Paranoia. And it's John Sweeney, who was the reporter, who went with a group of students from the LSE, the London School of Economics. A lot of criticism for it. For me, it raises several important questions, frankly. I mean, first of all, what kind of school sends their kids on a school trip to North Korea? We used to go all in towers if we'd been very well behaved. I mean, and John Sweeney, I don't know if any of you saw the programme. He was an undercover reporter with a group of students going to the most secretive and brutal totalitarian regime in the world. For a man who looks about 58, he didn't really look like a student. He was the worst undercover reporter I've ever seen. He looked like one of those, when you go on holiday with your mates and the dad drops you off at the airport and goes, you know what, I'm coming with you. He's had on his habit and someone's gone, who's brought the dad? And he's going, you know, don't call me Gerald, lads, I'm called Jezza now.
This is bizarre, because some of the students said that the BBC had endangered their lives, but if you're worried about danger, maybe you don't go to North Korea when they're threatening nuclear war.
Well, and the LSE is saying, you know, this is outrageous because it'll be much harder for us to study North Korea in the future. But you're thinking, why do you want to study North Korea? You know, I mean, if you want to look into some sort of crazy state where a leader dies and the whole country goes into sort of mental mourning for the best part of a fortnight, then you can stay much closer to home.
Sweeney, though, was fantastically pleased with himself, wasn't he? I mean, the ones who go undercover, they love that. They're on the telly going, I'm wearing special trousers that make me invisible, but I'm still incredibly brave and self-righteous. And he's standing there, looking through this barbed wire fence, saying, "Welcome to the real North Korea." I thought, I don't think anyone's under major illusions about North Korea. I haven't checked TripAdvisor, but I think it's roundly agreed to be a bit of a Kazi. I think it's pretty much on a par with Basingstoke. I don't think anyone...
If we're going to do these programmes and do a panorama North Korea special, I think we should go the whole hog and let's get Jeremy Kyle in there sorting out North Korea. "Dear leader, look at me, look at me. Let's sort this out, let's do a DNA test. He wasn't your dad." Let's do Strictly Come Dancing. Or in North Korea, Very Strictly Come Dancing.
The London School of Economics is furious that journalists from BBC's Panorama joined a group of LSE students on a tour of North Korea. Panorama reporter John Sweeney blended into the tour party of students by sleeping till lunchtime and posting pictures of himself on Facebook, stealing a traffic cone from outside the crypt of the eternal leader Kim Il-sung. At the end of round one, the scores are Rebecca and Jeremy have got 4 points, but so too have Hugo and Justin. We start round two with a listing spotted on Amazon.co.uk.
Karma Excitra, a sexual position guide with 3D hologram technology. Browse this section for more perfect Mother's Day gifts.
Rebecca, why do those that can't earn less?
Michael Gove issued a policy statement this week saying that teachers are highly trained professionals who should be allowed to educate our young people without government interference. Mm. Of course he didn't.
Ridiculous. Sorry.
No, he didn't do that. He slipped through another couple of edicts, which are just designed to wind up teachers, really. One of which was to do with performance-related pay, based on results, based on, you know, how much your pupils love you, and whether you run a hockey club after school. And it all seems to be based a little bit on that slightly kind of, "I'm only saying what we're all thinking" type of thinking. You know what I mean? That kind of, you know, "Ooh, they get such long holidays and it's all very easy for them." And I have a theory about this. I don't know if you noticed that, well, you may have done, Justin, because you just come down to London. It's quite difficult to get a cab in London at the moment. And my theory is that a large number of London cab drivers are holed up in a room somewhere. And they are, in fact, thinking up policy for Michael Gove.
Stuff was extraordinary. One of the keys to determining performance-related pay is wider outcomes for pupils. What on earth is that? We've entered you for a GCSE, but you did so well. You've also won this hi-fi system and a speedboat.
So there's part of their pay they will be rewarded if their pupils like them.
Yeah.
Yeah, then genuinely at my school, this would have worked brilliantly. The teacher would have come in at 9 o'clock and said, "Listen, lads, fill this form in. See you Friday." We'd have liked him a lot.
I mean, performance-related pay for teachers, it's not inherently a bad idea. You know, it depends how it's judged. It is very hard to sack bad teachers, and it's very hard to reward good teachers at the moment. Basically, it's not very surprising that the teaching unions hate this and hate Michael Gove, because they hate everyone. They basically slow hand-clapped every education secretary back for the last century. You could put Nelson Mandela and the Dalai Lama at the NUT conference, and they'd sit there going boo and flicking soggies at him off their rulers. You know? They're really, really angry people, and they always have
been. They spend all day with children. What do you expect them to be like?
Michael Gove, next time he stands in front of them, really, he should just go, "It's your own time you're wasting."
it would just be nice if they once liked something.
But, Hugo, this is bringing corporate culture into the classroom. I mean, I get the idea. The new system is supposed to stop situations in which excellent new teachers are poorly paid while, the older jaded teacher hated by the pupils and the parents is earning a fortune. And all you think when you hear that is that Michael Gove must recently have seen Matilda.
I think bonuses have worked so well in the world of finance that surely it's time to extend them into all areas of life.
I did a gig the other week and my old teacher came. He emailed me before he was coming and he sent me this email. He goes, "Hi, Justin, it's Mr. Townsend, your old maths teacher." He said, "I'm coming along to the gig. Be nice to meet you." And I emailed him back. I said, "Be lovely to meet you. He was a really great teacher. I remember him." And I sent him my phone number and he rang me. I picked the phone up and he went, "Hi, Justin, it's Terry." And I went, "Who?" He went, "Terry Townsend, your maths teacher." I went, "Just call yourself Mr. Townsend." Just leave it there.
About 6 months ago, I was having an argument with somebody about something on Twitter, and he started saying all these sort of sweeping things about my life and my childhood. And I replied and said, "Like, who the hell are you? Just leave me alone. You know nothing about me." And he said, "It's Mr. Robertson. I was your primary school teacher in primary five." Very nice man, actually.
Advice issued to head teachers by the Department of Education states that pupils' progress and behaviour can be used to assess teachers' suitability for performance-related pay. Christine Blair, the General Secretary of the NUT, said performance-related pay is increasingly discredited elsewhere as a means of motivating employees. Far better to let them have an extra 15 minutes at break time or let them bring in their own toys. Many teachers refused to describe themselves as angry with the changes. Instead, they shot a stern look over their glasses and said they were very, very disappointed. 2 points to Rebecca. Jeremy, who said getting high laid the economy low?
David Nutt, who was the bloke who was sacked by the last government because he said we need to legalise drugs because this isn't working, the war on drugs isn't working, so he got rid of him. Now, David Nutt's come up with a new theory, which is that the crash, the recent crash, was caused by cocaine, because he's observed that, you know, people doing a lot of cocaine are quite arsey and talk a lot and have very short attention span. And it's not physically addictive, but it is psychologically addictive. And the only way to get off cocaine is to go to Boots and buy yourself some Hubris patches. So it's not surprising that bankers do a lot of toot.
I love you talking about drugs, Jeremy. It's honestly two peppermint teas and you're off your face.
Imagine how surreal the banking crash would have been if they'd been on LSD instead.
If you'd had ecstasy, it would have been fantastic. We've lost a million, but I love you.
Can I just say, on the drug thing, I'd lied about Jeremy. He's actually on 2 asthma inhalers a day at the minute. That's true, isn't it? You do?
I do. I do a brown one and a blue one.
Yeah.
I do the brown one to get me going and the blue one just to level me off in the afternoon when I need some quiet chill-out time. I think they're quite jaunty asthma inhalers. It's a good prop. I've always wished I smoked, because it's good to have something in your hands that you can... And like reading glasses are good, because you can take them off and look sort of learned and wise and say things like, "But Inspector, there's something I don't understand." You know, and asthma inhalers are quite good.
It's like a pipe, isn't it? Like a pipe.
Yes, you can stand with your back to the fireplace, "Hey, we want to marry my daughter," and something like that.
I've never done drugs in my life, but I kind of get the thing about getting addicted to something. This is very middle class. I'm quite addicted to tiramisu latte at the moment. And can I just say, I draw the line at harder dips. Can I just say that?
I've just started smoking one of those electronic cigarettes. Have you seen them? They look like normal cigarettes, but they're electronic.
Does it taste of cigarette, darling?
It tastes kind of custard. Custard mixed with cigarettes.
Oh, super smart. So I've never been able to smoke, but I might try these.
You start this on that is, and work
yes,
up,
I'm
yeah.
I make my own alcohol patches with cider and Elastoplast.
Former government drug czar Professor David Nutt claimed that bankers high on cocaine caused the credit crunch. Professor Nutt claims cocaine causes bankers to take more risks. Presumably that and the sure knowledge that even if you ruin an entire country's economy, you can still avoid prosecution and get a £1 million bonus. 2 points to Jeremy. Hugo, who's bolting to the UK to make a very quick buck?
Usain Bolt.
2 points. Next question.
George Osborne has changed the law so that Usain Bolt can come back for... There's some kind of Olympics reunion happening next summer.
It's the anniversary games.
Right, yeah, that. Well done, 2 points.
Hang on a minute, I might win.
Bolt couldn't come into the UK or else he'd be liable for tax on all his earnings from stuff here. So they had to change the law to give him and other athletes an exemption so he's not here for so long that he has to pay tax. Although you'd think he would be able to be in and out quite fast. But apparently not fast enough.
It's a funny old thing, this anniversary games. It's meant to recreate last year's Summer Olympics. But you can do that from home. You just download the Chinese, the Japanese, the American national anthems and, I don't know, stare at a photo of Gary Lineker out of his depth. I would have thought... Apparently, Bolt is so fast, the papers claim he's going to earn £20,000 a second.
Just run slowly and make a killing.
Exactly, yeah.
Just do it as a stroll.
Yes, that's if he were a British athlete, he'd be much richer.
I hated sports day at school. I always had to be the shot put.
I was ill one sports day at school, but my mum said, "Boys, do you want to go to sports day anyway?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll go and watch." And I bought a raffle ticket. And I won a hamper of fruit. And I ran faster than I've ever run in my life. to collect this hamper, and I was so excited. I'd never seen anything as beautiful in my life. I kept it under my bed and wouldn't let anyone have any of the fruit in my family. And eventually it turned into sort of Lady Havisham's wedding feast. It was all blue and hairy with rats crawling all over it. And I just... But there you go. I'm having a bit of counselling now.
Thanks for sharing, Jeremy. Now, Usain Bolt and other high-profile athletes will return to the UK this summer to compete in the Olympic anniversary games following an amendment to British tax rules. Under the old rules, Bolt would not only have had to pay tax on his appearance fee and prize money, but also on a proportion of his worldwide endorsement income, which would mean handing the tax man 40% of all his Virgin Media pens and car stickers. In other news, Jimmy Carr is in training for the 100 metres. 2 points to Hugo. Justin, have a listen to this.
Deborah Harry's aged badly, hasn't she?
Justin, who had to explain his view on high earners one way or another?
This is a lovely story where in an ordinary week, the story of Vince Cable calling out One Direction would be the weirdest story of the week. But this is the week where we've also had a man punch his horse after a football match. and Justin Bieber wrote in Anne Frank's visitor's book in Amsterdam, I bet she would have been a believer. Vince Cable, he basically said it was immoral, that One Direction had earned £5 million each, and then he quickly backtracked when he realised that they had lots of fans and he would lose lots of votes in about 15 years' time when they could vote. I find the story fascinating, really. One Direction have earned £5 million each. That's Zayn, Niall, Harry, Lewis, Liam. Obviously, we're all familiar with them. I see them and I look, I just think, Nando's is missing a shift.
Apparently he misheard.
Yeah.
And
he thought that Harry Styles was the leader of an investment bank or something.
No, I think he didn't know the question was about One Direction at all.
It's funny that he didn't know about One Direction, because they talk of little else but fiscal stimulus.
Yes, that's true.
What's £5 million going to be worth in 60 years? And they're 19, they've had a payoff of that. And you think, yeah, but that is going to last you. And because they're kids, they're not going to be sensible and think, well, I've got this money, I should buy myself a modest home that will gain some value and is just what I need. Maybe I should buy myself a dry cleaning business also, because people always need dry cleaners. Dry cleaning always. And they're not going to think like that, are they?
I hesitate to pull you up, but actually they are sensible.
Oh, no.
Are they dull?
When the story was going around last year of people tax avoiding and one thing or another, on the bizarre page of The Sun, it had One Direction's showed how they were setting up companies each money was being drip-fed into pension schemes and offshore investments and all sorts of things.
It's happened to the world.
Bet Roger Whittaker never did that.
Boy bands and cabinets are a bit similar, because I was thinking about that. You always have the intense one, don't you? That's Osborne, presumably. The crier.
There's always a fat one.
Yes, and there's... who should we have?
Gary Barlow or Eric Pickles.
Eric Pickles. The one for the mums. Who's that? William Hague, do you think? William Hague for the mums?
Oh, dear.
Who's this?
Yeah, he's the most
probably
of a worry,
Cameron,
isn't he?
Cameron, actually.
Really? Cameron for the mums?
Charming and baby-faced.
And then there's the sensitive one. We could have Ken Clark on prison reform. We could be quite nice. And then Michael Gove on drums. Vince Cable has been forced to explain his position on the finances of boy band One Direction. Having originally declared their earnings grossly immoral, he later retracted his comments, saying he had misheard the question. The band were recently featured in the top 15 wealthiest British music artists under the age of 30 rich list. Oh, I'd have been in that if I was younger. And richer. And musical. And British. At the end of round two, the scores are Rebecca and Jeremy have got 8 points, but so too have Hugo and Justin. Before we start round three, here's a cutting from the West Sussex Police Neighbourhood Watch Bulletin.
A scam has been reported involving a man professing to sell mobile phones. When the victim checked the phone they believed they'd bought, they discovered they had in fact purchased 4 pints of milk.
That's something I bought. I bought 4 pints of milk, ended up with a phone and a 12-month contract.
Rebecca, who was too sexy for Saudi?
This is an odd little story. Three blokes went from the United Arab Emirates to Saudi for a cultural fair, and suddenly they were surrounded by a sort of SWAT team of police. And they were deported from the country on the basis that they were too good-looking mm. and that they would be irresistible to any weak-willed woman.
It happened to me.
I did think that immediately upsets any other man who's ever visited Saudi and left of his own accord, doesn't it? What a bizarre thing.
It's an extraordinary country, Saudi Arabia. It's the only country in the world in which women are not allowed to drive. I don't know, presumably we might think of a handsome man and lose all control of the vehicle. I don't know what would happen.
It's very insulting. I mean, some Muslims do think that human beings can't control ourselves, and in some Muslim places men can't wear shorts above the knee, and women can't show any part of their body at all, because people say, well, you see, because it arouses people. The trouble is, I mean, men get aroused by 3 minutes in an empty room, let's be honest. So, you know, but it doesn't mean that you can't control yourself, does it?
And generally, women are not aroused by men in short shorts.
How dare you?
It's impossible to believe that three men together would be irresistible. I mean, I've seen Top Gear, and...
It would be a great one, though, when you go back and they go, it must have been terrible, you got deported from a country. What happened? You went, I'm just too good-looking.
That's going to be a great excuse from now. Did you take that old sofa to the dump? Well, I tried. I got as far as the gate. The bloke from the council came out and he said, you're too buff, mate. You're too buff.
There are certain villages in Yorkshire that you can't go in if you've got basic body symmetry.
It's true, though. Some women can't handle themselves around men. I have to say, I'm a bit like that with Piers Morgan. No, I go crazy. One time I threw a kettle at the telly. Three men from the United Arab Emirates were forcibly removed from a cultural event in Saudi Arabia for being too handsome, amid fears that women would find them irresistible. I think I'd have been able to cope. The Commission for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vices, who up until now had been famous mostly for their office parties, feared women could fall for the men, which would be awful, as once that happened, there would be only the total ban on women interacting with unrelated men standing in the way of them starting up an unsuitable relationship. 2 points to Rebecca. Jeremy, have a listen to this.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
Jeremy, why are we running out of space for our rubbish?
Space junk. There's all this space junk, which is terrible. Do people not read the Countryside Code? Have they not seen Mike Lee's Nuts in May? Always leave the place as you found it. Take your litter home and don't leave open gateways to parallel universes. I was watching Channel 4 News, because I thought I'd better see what they've got to say about Lady Thatcher's funeral. Channel 4 News has gone very strange, because they have, like, three stories. That's it. They only talk about three things, and they're really long pieces. And sometimes the stories are not even big news. Like, they did Margaret Thatcher's funeral. Then they had a really long interview with a woman who's written a book about the glass ceiling, who's a Facebook millionaire. And Jon Snow he really handled it badly, because you think he was talking to some sort of horrible dictator. He went into sort of Paxman mode with this quite pleasant woman. And she said, well, I've written this book. And he was like, yeah, well, what do you write that for? Who cares about your book, you stupid cow? Was in a weird mood. And then they had this big thing about space junk, and they've got all these daft inventions that people in former polytechnics are making. There was a harpoon with a plunger on the end, you know, like a sink plunger. It reminded me of Tomorrow's World, the way of the future, when you were a kid, and they always got it wrong. They were so out of step with what was really going to happen. They'd say, if you have trouble making a telephone call and you can't find change for a kiosk when you're out of the house, have a look at this. Scientists believe that by the year 1980, we'll have this thing called the mobile telephonic device by using a very long cable and by putting your house on wheels. And it was all like that. They were basically saying, yeah, we'll have this special thing that you can do by putting chewing gum on a pigeon. It will fly into space and all the old bits of rusty satellite will get stuck on the chewing gum and then it will fly back.
Pigeon's like a sort of lint roller in space.
Yeah, it was all stuff. It was all weird ways
of getting...
It's
loads of stuff. There's about 23,000 pieces of space junk in orbit. And I have to say, I hadn't fully understood it. I don't think the number would be anywhere near as high if people in Australia were more careful and didn't keep dropping things.
Is this rubbish? Have I missed something? Because I'm very keen on recycling. Mm. This is not my papers that I bundle up carefully that I go into
no,
space.
Just... No, it's not that your sat-nav's got no signal because there's a Tesco's carrier bag around the satellite.
Right,
it's
right. Because I worry about that, because I'm a keen recycler, and this is genuinely a true story. 2 weeks ago, a man knocked on my door who'd been going through my recycling, and he said, "You've done very well." I said, "Thank you very much." He said, "But I do have to mark you down." I said, "Really?" He said, "You're not tearing your tea bags up."
What?
You can put tea bags into the recycling, but you're supposed to tear the bags. And I genuinely lost my temper. I said, "Mate, I have tried my hardest." I said, "But China are building a city a day bigger than the UK. I don't think me tearing up my Assam bag is going to make that much of a difference."
A conference will be held in Germany next week to discuss what can be done about the floating debris clogging up our skies, with solutions including a British-made space harpoon, a German robotic arm, and a Russian plan to send up Vladimir Putin to punch the objects into the sun. NASA scientists estimate there are more than 20,000 bits of debris floating in orbit, although they dramatically reduced the estimate after cleaning the lens on their telescope. The job of clearing away this space debris will be a quiet one because, of course, in space, nobody can hear you clean. Oh, settle down, people. 2 points to Jeremy. Hugo, where does police corruption really take the biscuit?
Devon and Cornwall. Basically, someone stole the biscuit tin.
Yeah.
And they've logged this as a crime. I haven't had that much to do with the police in my life. I've been very lucky. My bikes were stolen out of my shed about last year sometime.
Yeah. Did you get them back?
No, but the police came around to look at my shed and to make sure there weren't any bikes there. I mean, come on, guys. They came into the kitchen, we had a cup of tea, and they were saying, "So describe the bikes." And I was like, "Well, one of them was a hybrid bike," and the policewoman got out her notebook and she wrote down the word "high," and she looked at it for a while I stared at it, and I stared at her and stared at it. And then she crossed out the word "high" and wrote down "bike." They're brilliant, these people. I'm really surprised they couldn't find the biscuits.
What did they keep in the biscuit tin, though? Because biscuit tins don't always have biscuits in. It might have been rule plugs.
Let's just hope they finger someone for this crime. Well, chocolate fingered them.
They released a list of items stolen from police stations. 8 DVDs were stolen from Falmouth Police Station. A box set of training films called How to Prevent Crimes. There was a lace dress, hair tongs, 2 reflective vests, and the petrol cap off a panda car.
It's going to be a hell of a party.
Somebody's planning an amazing makeover. A tin of biscuits was stolen from the headquarters of Devon and Cornwall Police in Exeter and was officially recorded as a crime. The theft, or great biscuit robbery, as no one is calling it, was only disclosed following a Freedom of Information request. The theft of the biscuit tin was recorded, but no formal investigation took place because the evidence is wafer thin. Oh, this is what happens when you hobnob with criminals, please. Actually, coincidentally, the theft of a biscuit tin is the basis for the whole of the next series of new tricks. 2 points to Hugo. Justin, why are we happy to keep up with the Joneses in the bedroom?
Oh, well, this is a weird story that says that we are happy with the amount of sex we are getting, as long as we're getting more than next door. Which is weird, isn't it? And these surveys are really strange. It's like, how do they do these surveys by phone? Just, if somebody rings you up and goes, "Excuse me, did you have sex last night?" That's a dirty phone call. That's... There is absolutely nothing worse than you're lying in bed with your partner and you're here next door having sex.
It's...
Well, there is. It's lying in bed on your own and hearing your partner having sex next door.
I suppose, like everything, it's all relative. Well, especially in East Anglia. But it would be not... I mean, it's disappointing. I mean, if property prices weren't so ridiculous or this programme were on the television, not the radio, I might be able to afford a home with thick enough walls or enough land around it that I wouldn't know exactly what my neighbours are doing. Because people say, "Oh, the trouble is in London, no one knows anything about their neighbours." I know way too much about their neighbours.
Well, I live next door to ducks, and I know full well they're getting more than I am. Honestly.
They're dirty bastards.
Oh, the
ducks.
Racket, playing Barry White all times of the night.
Sure, they like Bill Withers, don't they?
Hey! According to a scientific study, frequent sex makes you happy, and having more sex than your neighbour makes you even happier, while an equilibrium can be reached by having frequent sex with your neighbour. Basically, the study carried out by sociologists at the University of Colorado found we feel happier the more sex we have. It's not clear how they found this information, but apparently all the scientists involved were delighted to be working on the project. 2 points to Justin. Before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings. The teams have brought along Ms. Front.
This is a cutting sent in by Lynn Tenkate, and it says, we can be justly proud of much of what we have achieved. At trust level, Epsom and St Helier was in the top 10% of NHS trusts for SMR, standard mortality rate. In simple terms, this means that your chance of dying in our hospitals was among the best in the country.
Mr Hardy.
Sandra, I'm indebted to David Barnett from the world of the internet. And it's an election flyer from the Gwynir, Gwythian and St Erth ward in Cornwall under the heading Renewable Energy. You either love it or hate it. Personally, I have mixed views.
Mr Rifkin.
This is from Jeff Pickthall in Cumbria, and it's from the Northwestern Evening Mail. The Evening Mail is hoping to speak to a local Crofts contestant. Are you entering your dog?
Mr Morehouse.
It's from John Stanley in Basingstoke, who ends his email to us by saying, thanks for making Friday evening tolerable. Chinan Park lent one of their courtesy coaches to move Reg the giraffe from Basingstoke and Dean Borough Council to the Hampshire Court Hotel in Chinan. Reg was created by Madeline Sly. Her inspiration for creating him came from the story of the Surabaya Zoo giraffe that died after being fed 16 to 20 kilos of litter by tourists, and a book which included instructions on how to make a papier-mâché giraffe.
Let's take a look at the final score. Rebecca and Jeremy have got 12 points, but this week's winners, entirely on a whim, are Hugo and Justin with 13. Before we leave you, here is a cutting from Home and Garden magazine sent in by Elizabeth Fenton.
Why not brighten up a white bathroom with splashes of colour in the form of towels or a colourful stool?
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Rebecca Front, Jeremy Hardy, Hugo Rifkind and Justin Morehouse. In the chair was Sandy Toksvig, and the news is read by me, Neil Sleet. The chair's script was written by Gareth Gwynn, Simon Littlefield and Tom Neenan, with additional material by Susan Murray, Rania Maguire and James Bug. The producer was Sam Bryant.